Well, good morning, everyone. We resume our study of Ecclesiastes, and very glad to see everyone. So if you want to open up to Ecclesiastes, we'll start there in just a moment. We're going to reflect back a little bit on chapter 1, but chapter 2 is going to be our focus today in Ecclesiastes. It's great seeing the Hamiltons back and with us. More than one now. And that's good. So very good. Let's start with a prayer. Daryl, would you lead our thoughts, please?
Lord God, we thank you for this day. We thank you for this time to meet together to study a portion of your word. And pray that as we go through this hour, you will help us to be attentive, help us to understand and learn things that will help us from day to day. Be with Philip as he prepares to teach us this morning. We pray for all of us. For our mutual encouragement in Christ's name. Amen.
So what did the wise preacher in Ecclesiastes set out to do? What's he trying to do?
Know and understand wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he's going to use wisdom in pursuit of what? Meaning. What profit is there in life? Life where? Under the sun. That's the context. It's life under the sun. That is the critical thing to understand in understanding this book, that it's confined to earthly life. In other words, if you take someone who knows nothing about God and you ask them to report on what they've experienced and seen, this is it. But this man had that experience as well as insight about God. And while the rest of the Bible is mostly about God's perspective on our lives and other things, this book is mostly about earthly perspectives and what God would want us to see in that and some things he would want us to know in knowing him. So what was his initial conclusion? He lays it out really quickly, his conclusion, which is what? Regarding meaning in life. Vanity. Vanity meaning empty or meaningless, just like air vapor. And as we begin to see his evidence for his conclusion that life is vain, what first set of evidence did he provide in chapter 1 that we saw the other day? That when you look at life,
nothing changes.
Okay? Nothing really changes. It's the same old, over and over and over, like a treadmill. And what were some specific examples of that?
Rivers flowing into the sea.
That's right. The water cycle. Rivers and so forth. Right.
The wind.
Right. The wind just keeps circulating and so forth. Even the physical universe around us has this repetition that appears to produce nothing. Nothing new. Okay? And that's his first body of evidence. And what he's describing there in that first chapter, the idea of working but getting nowhere. Now, we understand that this is about perspective. We understand that if your grass is growing up and you go out and mow it, it looks more neat and trim, okay? We understand that you've got like a tool shed that's falling in disrepair and you get out there and you repair some of the boards on it and fix a window and you paint it. It improves it. It looks better. Of course, then what happens when you come back in 15 years? Got to do it again. Got to do it again. It's that cycle, isn't it, Frank? Okay? We understand that there are some ways in which it looks like we're making progress, but the big picture is that it's really a cycle over and over and over. So we're going to get into chapter 2 today, and we're going to see that there are a couple other things he's doing here. Really, chapters 1 and 2 sort of lay the foundation for the rest of the book, and the rest of the book sort of echoes the first two chapters, adds a little bit more. And then he adds wise sayings and counsel for us in the rest of the book. He's going to talk in chapter 2 about obtaining but not being satisfied. And he's going to talk about accomplishing but not being able to really retain what you have accomplished, that it slips through your fingers. All right, so, and this is, he really gets frustrated in this chapter. He really does. In a way, what we're seeing here is that he's talking about the idea that you get what you want, you get all that you want, and it's still not enough. And I guess we would put it in our kind of culture, it's when the good life isn't really that good after all. Have you ever noticed how that people who, from an earthly standpoint, life under the sun standpoint, that they get money, they get fame, they get influence, but yet you hear of a significant amount of alcoholism, drug abuse, getting in trouble with authorities, their family relationships, their marriages and relationships with their children being atrocious in many cases. There are exceptions to this. And the amount of suicide. Occasionally we hear someone who's rich and famous and they commit suicide and it's a head scratcher. They've got it all. You know what happens? They learn that even when you get it all, it's not enough. And that's the most disappointing thing of all. Because you think, only if I could just get it all. This is what I want and this is what I want. Well, most of us never get to that point. And so we understand that there's like this carrot dangling out there on that stick and we just keep going. What if you don't just get the carrot? You get a whole field of carrots. And you bite into every carrot. And when you finish biting into the carrots, you're still hungry. No wonder they end it all. Okay, let's get into this. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. Les, will you read those first three verses for us, please?
I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life.
All right, thank you. This talks about two avenues here, okay? Now, we've already talked at the end of chapter 1 that he tried to find the meaning of life through wisdom. He's going to return to wisdom in chapter 2. He now speaks of another way in which he tried to find meaning and fulfillment in life. And the first thing he talks about here is pleasure. Now, when you laugh and you have a good time, what does it do for you in the moment? You laugh and have a good time. You do something with friends, you go out in some kind of, you know, recreation, or you read something that's humorous. What?
Makes you happy.
What'd you say? Makes you happy. You enjoy it. It relaxes you. There's some relief. How long does it last? Very momentary. And if you have some real big problems and issues in your life, what happens to those in spite of how much you laugh? They're still there. When you walk out of the movie theater, when you turn off the stereo, or whatever you turn off, you know, your device, problems are still there. Okay? What's the second thing that he says here that he used as an avenue for finding meaning? Wine. Okay? Use wine. Partaking of that pleasure while the mind observes. Now, we had a pretty long discussion about wine. We studied Proverbs the other day. And wine in the Bible does not necessarily mean alcoholic wine. It might not. They also drank wines when they were somewhere in along the fermentation stage. Okay, so the amount of alcohol could be very small. But we also saw that commonly in ancient times, they mixed the wine with water. But understand what wine meant. You know, we have all these beverages today that are very flavorful. But what if you only had water and milk to drink and juice? That's really all they had in ancient times. Water, some kind of milk, and some kind of juice. They also had fermentation of grains, which is what you would call today an ale or a beer. Okay? But that was not as common in Palestine. It was juice of the grape. So you can imagine, you know, what the juice of the grape does to your palate. It's very pleasurable. And of course, then it could be fermented wine. But the idea of the wine there is it's another form of the pleasure. Maybe or maybe not alcoholic involvement there. Okay? And we're going to see, he doesn't make a conclusion about wine yet, but he's going to make a conclusion about all of these things he's talking about. And let's look at what else he talks about. All right? Earl, can you read verses 4 through 11?
I enlarged my work. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. And I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate forests, growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. I also possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers, and the pleasures of men, many concubines.
All right, thank you.
Did you say through 11?
Yeah, through 11.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, I jumped ahead. Sorry, my bad. Okay. Keep going, Errol.
Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me, and all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity, as striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun.
All right, thank you. What all was he able to acquire?
Pretty much all he wanted.
Pretty much all he wanted. Matter of fact, he says in verse 10, what? How's he put it?
He didn't refuse himself anything.
Everything my eye desired, I got. I didn't refuse myself anything. You know, when it comes to things we want in life under the sun, not very many people can be in a position to acquire everything they want. Even sometimes all the money in the world can't get you everything that you want. What were some of the things he listed there? And don't we have to conclude here that this might not be an exhaustive list? It could have gotten more detailed. Understanding what he's saying here, which meant there are some subcategories he could have had. But what does he describe? He had what?
Houses,
vineyards, forests,
slaves,
servants, concubines, and
nice,
everything.
Nice landscaping.
Land, gardens, all that. He had all of it. Okay? What could be some modern parallels? If you're a person who looked with your eyes and you desired things and you could... You wouldn't have to deny yourself anything. What are some modern things we could add to that? Cars. And some people, I mean, you hear about these rich people that have like 30 cars, collectible cars and stuff. What?
Computers, musical instruments.
All kinds of electronic things, musical instruments.
Airplanes.
Yachts. What?
Yachts.
I mean,
rockets.
Okay, man. Our senior man is up on the latest news. He is up on the latest news. There is this competition between two of the richest, most full of themselves guys in America. I'm just going to say it. They probably would admit that. They would say, that's a secret to my success. I'm full of myself. I'm great. Look at me. And they're in this competition to get into space. Okay? And they've gotten into space, I suppose. I wonder what's going to happen when one of those things blow up. You know, they do blow up every now and then. Okay, and if he's on it, one less rich guy. Okay, so anyway, I mean, this is so real life, isn't it? When you start tying to real life, it's just all around us. That's why we're doing these quotes. I mean, he went all the way. But in the end, what was his conclusion? Oh, let me back up. It did provide what? Accomplishing all this and building all this, at the end of verse 10, what did he experience in his heart?
Pleasure in his toil.
It's like, yeah, wow, this was enjoyable building this. You know, I looked out of that landscape and it was just, you know, barren. And now look at it. It's a thriving green garden. Wow, it makes me feel good. So again, you got to look at perspective here and the relative perspective. To some extent, it gave him pleasure to do these things. But in the end, what was his conclusion? After a while, once that excitement was over, just like the laughter, once he built those gardens and those houses, emptiness. That's exactly right. New International, which I think, just to tell you, because my perspective, New International has some real issues in the New Testament, but it's a translation that has a lot of insights, especially in the poetry literature of the Old Testament. It says in verse 11, "Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." This man had gained everything. But in the end, he says, "I really had gained nothing under the sun." It's startling. So what this is teaching us is that when it comes to possessions and pleasure, there's a paradox. What is the paradox of possessions and pleasure? You want them so badly, and you think, this is going to make me happy, and then what happens?
Well, they also, the more possessions you have, the more worry and anxiety you have.
And that robs some of that. You don't anticipate some of the negatives about them.
And they're inanimate, so there's no relationship.
Yeah, there's no relationship.
They don't give anything back except what you had at the moment.
Yeah, there's no interaction.
George Vanderbilt, you know.
He only... I'm a little rusty in my Biltmore history, but I think he lived 15 years in the house. 15 years he died of cancer. He's fairly young when he died. Go ahead. Was it five? Okay. I'm rusty. Still, either way, right? Go ahead. You had a comment.
Well, I was saying you asked, you know, if songs or poetry is things like that coming by and studying the song, Mick Jagger wrote a song, you know, can't get no satisfaction.
Oh, man.
You know, in his, probably he was one of those people in the prime of his wealth and popularity and, you know, women all over him all the time, and so he seemed to be a person who would have, you know, some kind of satisfaction. But he wrote a song and said, "I can't get him, can't get no satisfaction," which is a double negative, of course.
Right. Him, but, yeah, you know, but it doesn't.
I don't think that was his point.
Though. That was not his point. That was just that thing that rock and roll people like to do—bad grammar. But yeah, okay. Les didn't know this. I didn't know he was going to make that comment. My very next point. When I'm driving in my car and a man comes on the radio, he's telling me more and more about some useless information supposed to fire my imagination. I can't get no. Oh, no, no. Hey, 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 that's what I say. I can't get no satisfaction. Don't worry. I want to break out and sing these, but I'm not going to. Exactly it. It's one of their biggest hits, too. And they were at the peak, starting to peak at that point. Yeah, Rick.
Reminded me of the Who. They have, I think it's Bob O'Reilly, "Meet the New Boss, the Same as the Old Boss." I mean, it's, you know, just this over and over again.
There you go. No new thing. Yeah. Okay. There is this paradox. It's like there's this gift, and it's got this incredible, shiny, fancy wrapping and bows on it. And you tear into it. And you start digging through the box, and there's all the styrofoam, the peanuts. And you just keep burying your hands in it, and that's all there is. It's just the styrofoam peanuts. That's all it is. That's every gift, in a way. Okay? That's every gift. Even having it all gets you nothing. That's what he says. Wow. Yes, Rachel.
Well, I think it takes us back to the chapter 3, verse 11. Okay. That God created mankind and human beings to not be satisfied with things under the sun and that are temporary. And so people are constantly going to be trying to find that thing that fulfills them, whether it's, you know, through pleasure or possessions or activities or whatever it is.
Right.
Because that is how God made us.
Thank you for tying that together. That is evidence that there is something different about us. Why are we so dissatisfied with these things? Because there is something about us that longs for more meaning than that. It's evidence of that. 3:11 statement. Well, he returns in verse 12 to wisdom. Ken, can you read that for us? 12 to 17, please. 12 to 17.
So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same events happen to them all. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why they have been so very wise. And I said in my heart that all this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and striving after the wind.
Thank you. Now, this is where you let the book unfold and you get a full picture. We just studied in Proverbs. We're reading in Proverbs about the immense value of wisdom. But we read earlier in this book, at the end of chapter 1, how that he tried to use wisdom to find meaning in life, and it still was empty. But then he adds more to this. He returns to wisdom, but he's looking at it at a different angle. It's like he's walking around life, looking at it from different angles, and he's seeing it, okay? What does he say here about wisdom? When he contrasts the wise man and the fool, does the wise man have any advantage? At the first, what does he say here? Verse 14.
There's more gain in wisdom.
There's more gain in 13 and 14. There's gain in wisdom. What else? Because a wise man can what?
He can see.
He can see. In wisdom, there is light. And it's always better to be in the light than in the darkness. So there is an advantage to having wisdom. But in the end here, verse 16, 15 to 16, what eventually happens to both the wise man and the fool? They die. They all end up in the same place. Now their journey through life, the fool is bumping into things all the time and hurting himself because he can't see where he's going. Remember, we kept talking about wisdom and seeing down the road and anticipating that and making the right adjustments. The fool keeps blooding his nose and busting his knee and everything like that, falling and knocking out teeth. And the wise man maneuvers life a little better. So wisdom has huge advantages. But in the end, what? They're both taken to the grave. So from that perspective, wisdom is not advantageous.
Jesus talks about we love darkness and how it is that we're supposed to walk in the light.
Why are people foolish? They love darkness and they love being foolish. Yeah. Exactly right. He describes that, doesn't he? So death is the great leveler, which ends up with the same conclusion. This vanity, death itself, makes life pointless unless there's something beyond death. And that changes the equation. If there's nothing beyond death, nothing matters. Really. But what if there is? Yeah.
Wasn't there a bumper sticker I used to see that said the man with the most toys still dies? Or something like that?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I think I saw a bumper sticker.
Yeah.
The man with the most toys still dies.
Still dies. I think that's a play off the... I think that's a play off the statement, the one with the most toys wins.
Yes.
And I think that was a comeback to say, oh yeah, he dies though. Which is Ecclesiastes yes. 2. Okay, he still dies. Well, there's one more avenue that he talks about here in chapter 2 of pursuing, and that's the idea of legacy and posterity. So, 18 to 23. Vince, can you read that for us, please? Down to 23.
Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity.
All right, thank you. So, what's this other approach? Well, maybe I can find meaning in even what I've built up, because I can do what with it? Leave it to somebody. However, whoever you leave it to, what? Might be a fool. So let's go with George Vanderbilt. I hadn't had it on my notes, but I don't know why I didn't. I would say this to you, a really great book to read with Ecclesiastes. It's called Lady on the Hill. They sell it over there. So just go get one at the library. It's pretty expensive. But Lady on the Hill, it's all about how he built it and then what's happened since. Oh, it's a great companion to Ecclesiastes. But George dies. I mean, that place over there, it's incredible, okay? He dies a few years afterwards of cancer. His wife nor his daughter knew how to handle it. Edith, I think, was his wife's name. Cornelia was his daughter's name. It was in shambles until three generations later that Bill Cecil came over here in the late 40s, early 50s, and started rebuilding it. And it took everything they had, and it was just bit by bit. But you know, guess what? The Cecils are going to leave it to somebody. So, it's just that cycle over and over and over. But exactly what George did was incredible. He was an incredibly talented man in many ways. But the people he initially left it to, it fell into repair. Disrepair, sorry. And they were living in a little corner of it because they couldn't keep it up. And partly because he'd spent all his money on it and they had nothing left. So it's an incredible story alongside this, as well as Mick Jagger and everybody else. Go ahead, Wes.
Well, what you said, just to support your thing there, Jim and I went up to Newport, Lebanon, Island a few years ago, and there was a book in one of the gift shops in one of those huge mansions. There's Lebanon. We saw it in Lebanon. But there was a book of all the ones that had been torn down, which was a whole book of them. And all during these Gilded Age, wealthy people, they were all building these mansions in Newport. And they were nearly all torn down because the families did not keep them up after the initial parents died. And the ones that are open to the public now are being kept up by a historical society in which all the money goes to if you buy a ticket to go to them. So not even the families live in them that, you know, are the heritage of them.
Great illustration. Great. Right on the money of this, isn't it? And that wasn't that long ago they were built. I mean, they were. I think you told me they were torn down probably mid-20th century or something like that. Yes. Okay. And look in verse 17 and 20. Back in 17 when he concludes about the wisdom, and then verse 20 when he concludes that I'm going to leave it and I'll have no control over it because a fool could take it and just mess it up. What's his emotional state and mental state in verse 17 and 20?
Despair.
Fear, frustration. I mean, he's at wit's end. Okay. Yeah, if it's Solomon, yeah, I mean, a lot of this really fits Solomon. Don't know for sure, but a lot of it really does fit Solomon. And this emptiness and this vanity was just, it ended up overwhelming him and crushing him. Okay, here's another quote for you. I stick with the rock theme. I close my eyes only for a moment, and the moment's gone. All my dreams pass before me, pass before my eyes, a curiosity. Dust in the wind, all they are is dust in the wind. Same old song, just a drop of water in an endless sea. All we do crumbles to the ground, though we refuse to see. Dust in the wind. All we are is dust in the wind. Now, don't hang on. Nothing lasts forever but the earth and sky. It slips away, and all your money won't another minute buy. Dust in the wind, all we are is dust in the wind. Everything is dust in the wind. Kansas. How do these guys write this? Because it's true. And it's true because that's how life works. And all this poetry that these people have generated, and it seems like the 20th century really generated a lot of this. And again, it takes a society that is prosperous and mighty to really, really to sing these kinds of songs. Okay? And what it confirms to us is exactly what the Bible is saying here, which then should pull us in to say, well, what else does the Bible say? Is there more to somehow get through this and over this? So that's it. And so this is a good example of him injecting in these little moments these rays of light. Remember we talked about Ecclesiastes is like being in a dark tunnel, but every now and then pokes through a ray of light. And that's what you have in 24 to 26. 24 to 26. Neil, will you read that for us, please, the end of that chapter?
There is nothing better for a man than you should eat and drink, to make his soul enjoy good from his labor. This is also a song that is from the hand of God. Who can eat and who can have enjoyment will die. For the man that pleases with him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy, and sinner and giveth travail. Together and to keep up that he may give to him that pleaseth God. This also is vanity. Let's try that.
All right, thank you. Right at this point, and you get so far in this book and you're like ready to lay it down because it's going to depress you so much that you can't take another second of it. And then he says this. I mean, after saying that you have everything you want and you're still dissatisfied and you're empty and life is vain, but then he says, enjoy it. How? Okay. Perspective again. In spite of the futility of life, we are told by this man here, his advice here is to enjoy it anyway. So here's the deal. You really can enjoy this life when you realize how rotten it is. When we expect too much of this life, and we expect it to do this and fill us up this way, and then it doesn't, we're frustrated and we're disappointed every time. When we realize that earthly pursuits are vain and that there is an emptiness to it all, then we can just sit back and enjoy it for what it is. It's like a person's got cancer and they pick up this apple, and it's a beautiful apple. And they're like, I'm going to eat this apple and it's going to cure my cancer. And they bite into it and it's just sweet and perfect, crisp. But it doesn't cure the cancer. Somebody else picks up the apple and says, that's an apple. It just grew in a moment of time. Came from God's earth. It looks beautiful. I'm going to bite into it and it just feels good and it tastes good. And it's just crunchy and sweet. And I eat it and it's great. It's enjoyable. And then you go on. Because that's all it can do. So whatever there is to enjoy in this life, you enjoy it, but don't expect it to fill up that empty bucket deep down inside your soul. It's not going to do it. Back to Rachel's point about 3:11. Yes.
It just goes back to the two people who are going through life. One is walking in darkness, bumping into everything. To the extent that we can enjoy this life, it's depending on our ability to navigate and take God's wisdom to help us navigate this world. Right. To that extent, we can enjoy this life.
And that takes wisdom to be able to see it that way. Okay, I just didn't really enjoy that apple. That's great. But you know, guess what? I'm going to be hungry in another few hours. I know that. I know I just enjoyed it for that moment, but I put it in perspective. I know it's not going to satisfy me. And then you can apply that to 50 acres or a mansion or a bank, a bank full of money or whatever. Okay, that's good in this and I'll enjoy it. And then, but it's not going to really last. When I expect it to, there you go. And then he talks about this injection of God here in life under the sun, where he says, verse 26, for the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. So, it's possible to live your life in a way where you know this God and you walk with him, and he is the one that gives you real joy. While the fool who doesn't see God, who's trying to milk life under the sun for all of its, pleasure and goodness, and he comes up empty, actually, the one who's trying to gather and collect, he's going to come up empty. But the person who lives life, but they live life with God and live life understanding that God really gives you the joy even through those things, that's the person who ends up in the advantage. He's describing in verse 26, the one who's with God and sees God having an advantage of the ones who don't, okay? In other words, knowing God frees us up to see what value there is in this life with the right expectations. But if you don't, you end up so frustrated. Bertrand Russell was a British everything in the 20th century. Started off as a math whiz. He's a mathematician, big academic. But he wrote philosophy and history. And he was like, if Bertrand Russell said something in the 20th century, people, lean in and listen, okay? This is what he said about what life is. This is what human work is. First, altering the position of matter at or near the earth's surface relatively to other matter. And second, telling other people to do so. What he said was, work is moving things on the earth or telling somebody else to move it. And that's it. And what he's saying here is, really, people, you think life's a big deal? All it is just moving matter one place to the other, moving objects, or getting somebody to move it. If you look at your work every day, that's all it is. That's what he says, okay? And this is what Wordsworth said, another Brit. The world is too much with us, late and soon. Getting and spending we lay waste our powers. Remember how he is in verse 17 and 20? He's drained. He's frustrated. If all you're doing is just trying to gain and you think that's going to fill you up, it leaves you so empty and frustrated. It wears you out. There is no joy if it's just life under the sun. But realizing there is a God and living acceptable to Him means that there is more to this life under the sun, which Ecclesiastes does not go into. The rest of the Bible does. But the book of Ecclesiastes tells us that even though life is vain in many ways and short in its rewards, if you walk with God, what little enjoyment there is, you're content with that instead of frustrated. That's what he's depicting here. Rick, what did you have to say?
Well, you struck a chord with the moving matter around comment because, you know, I work in construction. I work on these beautiful homes sometimes and things such as that. Have you ever thought how many 200-year-old homes there are around us? Hardly any.
Uh-oh.
So in 200 years, what are we going to see with all these homes that are being built, no matter how magnificent they might be? How many cars are 100 years old? You know, we think cars and homes are those things that are going to make us happy, and they're fleeting.
So take that Russell quote in light of what you said. So here's lumber and metal and everything else that comes up and forms a house. And then after a while, somebody either tears it down, it burns down, or it falls into disrepair, and that matter just goes to another position. it's this matter in and out, moving along, and we think it's a big deal and satisfying that we can move that matter or tell somebody to do it. And in the end, you end up like this man, just empty and frustrated. Yes, it just shrivels up. Exactly right. Okay. Yes, Rachel.
Well, and I think that on the flip side of all of the, if everything under the sun is temporary and not lasting, doesn't mean anything, then all the problems that we deal with, it's just temporary.
He doesn't overtly state it. But that is reflective of contemplation. Wow, what pressure the things he's saying here, look how much pressure and burden that takes off of us. So what? The roof leaks. So what? The car breaks down. And we all get frustrated. This is what I do, you know. I have that reaction, I get frustrated, and then I have to think it through. And then when I think it through, I'm like, it's just sort of funny. But you have to sit and think through. And there's that thing about light and darkness. You got to have something to say, okay, give me perspective about this. And God's the perspective. The rest of the Bible is the perspective. Okay. All right, thank you so much.